From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet. Best is yet to come.
The best is yet to come. Babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway.
It's possible that you've heard of my next guest, but impossible that you've never heard of at least one of his clients. In the 40 years Phil Ramone's been in the business, he's worked with Bob Dylan, Frank Sinatra, Billy Joel, Madonna, Luciano Pavarotti, to name a few. He's won 13 Grammy Awards and an Emmy, and after just finishing up Tony Bennett's chart-topping duets, he'll be releasing Gladys Knight's latest called Before Me. Oh, and did I mention that he played a major role in putting music onto CDs in the early 80s? It is with great pleasure that I welcome Phil Ramone to my show today.
Hello. Thank you, thank you.
When I interviewed Tony Bennett just recently for Duets, I mentioned that you'd produced the record and asked him what you did for it, and he answered with a question. He said, "What does a producer do?"
Uh-huh.
Is that something you get asked a lot?
Yeah, I think people really don't know how to describe what it is we do in the booth. We're not kind of yes men, but we're more like a director of a film. You know, our job is to take the elements and like a script. In that, my case, it's the music, and decide and work on the arrangements with both composer, if it's a singer-songwriter, or if it's a star like Tony Bennett, who the repertoire is part of his life. And he speaks to that and then kind of direct the thing into what the big goal is.
I assume that if it's somebody like Tony Bennett, somebody who's been around and knows exactly what is good for him and what he likes, that you're more hands-off than if it's somebody who's just breaking into the business, or somebody's come to you and said, "Phil, my career is going down the tubes. Help me."
Well, I think he, after 50 years, certainly has all the qualities of a man who knows what he wants to hear. But I think most people in a good position of being great artists want the reliability both of, in this case, a great engineer, his son, and my services, and his other son, Danny. Dave Bennett and Danny Bennett are really integral parts of what makes a good record.
How different is it now with someone like Billy Joel than when you first worked with him in the late 70s?
I think the only difference is the road is tougher in the sense of our sensibilities. We started out, we were quite young, and he had had a huge hit, and he'd had 5 years of sort of great recognition as a songwriter, but nothing had happened in the pop market, so to speak. Then we did The Stranger. And I think we hit it off so well because the quality of the songs certainly were in the same category as Turnstiles and other songs he had written. But I think we found a production way of working and an extreme honesty, which is kind of the way you want to go. And we sat the other night in a restaurant and not reminiscing, just looking at what the future of great artists is and the changes that have come about. But the standards and the fact is that you want quality. You want quality and believability. That still stands.
My guest is Phil Ramone, music producer, one of the founders of A&R Records. This is WNYC, and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, what happens if somebody comes to you with a song you don't like? Is there a nice way of saying, I really don't think this one is making it?
Well, I think you learn your diplomatic skills as part of your job. You're there as a confessor about ideas. You're definitely in the position of having to be objective. And in that role, once you've proved yourself to somebody, if I said to you, boy, that sure is a wonderful song, it has some moments that are having problems. I mean, it's better to say that than some people who say it
what
just
a piece of junk.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your
language. What were you thinking?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are songs that come about that are just not going to make it, you know, but then you put it up against the other two or three, and you say, you're on such a great path here. You really are. I mean, you're letting your soul out, and people want to identify with that. If it's going to be cutesy and something else, let's figure it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
So is that what happens? Do people then go back and fix up the song or say, oh, maybe this is not worth
it? Well,
sometimes
I go sit at the piano with them and say, you know, maybe this lyric is leading us somewhere else. Melody's great. I mean, I think you can't look at somebody directly in the face and just say, that's ugly. I mean, that's just silliness to do that.
But does it help that you started as a musician?
I think it helps a lot. At least if you make a reasonable connection to them out of respect and you don't try to write their song, you're going to say something in their corner.
I wonder if you're the only rock producer who started out playing classical violin.
Don't tell anybody.
How old were you when you played?
Well, I started when I was three. You know, I was just one of those fortunate children whose parents just kept saying, this is not serious, he'll get over it. And I just kept taking lessons, and it grew from there.
You mean it wasn't one of those things where your parents said, we want you to take violin lessons?
No, they didn't say they didn't. I think they wanted my sister and I to be, you know, reasonably taught, and why not? It certainly wasn't a career choice.
And how long did that last?
Well into my teens, and started working in a recording studio when I was 16 as in this, you know, coffee boy and learning. I just got fascinated because the early days of my career was doing some guest appearances on television, and the control room was my favorite place to be.
You did guest appearances. You were that good a violinist?
Yeah, I guess I was a novelty, you know, a little kid in short pants, and he plays classical violin, easily fittable into a script.
And you recorded?
Yeah.
With orchestras.
Right.
So, but it's amazing to me that with all of that background, you didn't wind up producing classical recordings.
I felt.
Except for Pavarotti.
Well, Pavarotti and Andre Previn and a couple of people. But I felt that there were so many wonderful producers in the world of classical music that it was a very narrow field for me to try to get into. And my instincts were very much headed towards jazz. I wanted to play jazz. Loved blues and pop music and grew up with when rock and roll was born.
So you probably wound up at Atlantic Records with somebody like Tom Dowd.
Oh, you bet. Well, Tom Dowd became a customer of A&R Recording. We had this little funky studio where people gathered. It had no air conditioning, and it was really just a good-sounding little room. And he brought the overflow, and that I got introduced to Nesawi Erdogan and Ahmed Erdogan, did some Coltrane and some people like Ray Charles, a few other great artists.
You had created a state-of-the-art recording studio, it wasn't as common as it is today, was it?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I think that our adventure into being an independent studio was so far removed from the public normal world of recording. You went to Decca, if you were signed to RCA or Columbia, that's where you recorded. The little independent studios that became famous, like Bell Sound and Mirror Sound and people like that, were we did the music for these tiny labels. And there was a lot of independent business at that time.
The exception was jazz, where everybody had to go to New Jersey to Rudy Van Gelder's house.
Except that, you know, Creed Taylor, who was head of Verve, came to A&R. And if we hadn't run out of space and time, because Creed was very much a 10-to-1, 2-to-5 person, But we ended up doing quite a bit of wonderful work for him.
So if you're recording jazz and then you're recording a rock act, how much does the recording studio have to change? And how much do you have to rearrange everything?
Well, at the beginning, I started by building booths for the isolation of the singer and the group.
Was that something that was done commonly in those
days? No.
Because now that's the way everybody works.
Yeah, but it was rather unusual, and it was against the union rules to cut tracks, which now it's commonplace. You make music, and you either put the singer in or you put him in later. Or you might cut with them, as I do a lot, with the singer in the booth, in their special booth. But it isolated the studio enough that people started coming there. And the heavy, big pop songs of the day, or the Burt Bacharach with the hits coming out of him, Dionne Warwick having a little isolation just made the date go a lot better.
So you were recording those records for Burt Bacharach?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That has to be very exciting when you do something and it winds up becoming an almost instant hit. But I know I've been in recording studios where everything just clicked, everything was great, and everybody said, this is a hit. And, of course, it wasn't.
No, of course.
Does the excitement take over in situations like that?
It does. I mean, I can remember the Bacharach dates with everybody's family coming to the date. It was quite common. I mean, my mom would be sitting in the corner because Bert felt superstitious because she was sitting in the room knitting something, a scarf for him, and they had a number one record. She was about at 8 sessions following that. I mean, people
must have got a lot of scarves out of that.
Oh, yeah, a lot of scarves.
But, in those days, you pretty much recorded live, and then you say now that's no longer the case. But with Tony Bennett's Duets album, the new one, went back to the old way. I don't even know if you recorded the drum parts on click tracks, as everybody seems to do today.
No. It's natural. I had done the Sinatra record in 1993, and that was all live, except for some of the vocals, which... because he was not comfortable being back in the studio, and he certainly didn't want to sing opposite someone. So we did all of that, the famous phone your part in, but it really wasn't. They really did sing in other studios.
And then the trick is making it sound like they're in the same place.
Yeah, exactly. And then Tony said to me, because he'd been on that album, he said, I don't want to do that. I want to really record. We set it up kind of a small nightclub style, rhythm section in front of him, and everybody looking. The surprise part of it was when the guests would arrive and they realized, oh, we're going to do this live. And I put my arm around them and say, not only live, but probably in 2 or 3 takes.
And they've never done anything like that. Now people record sometimes, they record a record in, by the bar practically.
Yeah. I think we go through evolution and it's fine because most of the great artists really do this when they perform. They're doing it every night. So
what are the advantages and the disadvantages of working one way or the other?
I think one is you look, and you can't help it, but you want to be more perfect than you've ever been. You worry that the audience that's been out there needs to hear you in the best possible way. The greatness of most artists, including many albums I've done with Elton John, where we've called it one night only, and we go in and suddenly... we do it all in one night, live at Madison Square Garden, let's say, that challenge puts the band and us and him at a new level. And I think in the recording studio, we tend to slow down, look at everything very carefully, and probably overdo our edits.
And sometimes classical musicians tell me it takes all the life out of a performance. If you're going to do everything exactly perfectly, and in some cases, the 35th take to get this very complicated line, it just takes all of that special energy that comes from a live performance out of it.
Oh, it definitely changes the attitude. And I think if you're in the studio and you think that something is going to change, and I'm okay because I can do 12 more takes of it, it allows the musicians to let down a little bit.
But every time there's been a change, people have complained. When you started doing this sort of thing and editing things in, people said, oh, it's just unnatural. And then when analog was replaced by digital, people said, oh, this is just going to ruin the whole thing.
Correct. I mean, it's perfectionism is one thing. Fear of not having the best, greatest performance really puts amazing things into people's lives. You wouldn't believe how they sit there and really stretch their mind and say, can I, should I? And then there are those that come from that school that say, look, this is the way it really is. And it can accept a certain kind of imperfection, intonation, things like that.
My guest is Phil Ramone, who's one of the greatest music producers of all time, the founder of A&R Recording Studios. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break, and let's listen to something he recorded with Billy Joel.
Cheia de graça, ela, menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço, caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que um poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, porque estou tão sozinho? Ah, porque tudo é tão triste? Ah, beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes.
And Astrid Gilberto, the girl from Ipanema, one of the many hit records that Phil Ramone produced. I don't know whether you did this at A&R Studios or not, but I can't imagine that when that was recorded, everyone would have thought it would become the monster success it became.
Well, Creed Taylor was the producer. I was the, and I'll say, young engineer at the time. But it was...
Did you get really into the technical sides of that? Because something like this had to be recorded very suddenly, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think our studio took off from that kind of reputation. Obviously, many Brazilian artists and people who wanted this sensitivity. The studio was very simple, and Creed trusted it and trusted what we did with it. And, I mean, you can't duplicate anything that isn't there in the first place.
Astrid Gilberto wasn't even supposed to be on that. What happened? She was just hanging around?
She's his wife. She's Joao's wife. And Norman Gimbel came in with a translation, or not really a translation, his own lyric for The Girl from Ipanema. And Creed Taylor said, let's record it. Now, there's several stories about how this goes, but the one I know is the one I experienced, which is where she got up from the couch in the control room and went out and did a couple of takes, and we were going to send it to Sarah Vaughan the next morning so that a great song like this in English with this complete bossa nova, which was just beginning. It hadn't even taken off yet. Stan Getz, of course, was the great saxophone player. And, you know, it led to Gilberto and all these people, Jobim, the amazing part of my life starts all right there.
And you said they came to you. So is that generally how it works? Did they come to you? Or do you ever call up an artist and say, you know, I would love to work with you?
I don't do that. I think it's just a matter of that your last record speaks for itself or something else you might have done. And at the time, it wasn't a conflict of interest. Believe it or not, eventually it became a conflict that people thought you had your own studio and why would you have me there? But everybody wanted to record at A&R. It wasn't until years later, which is now in custom, is that they love to, if you have a room and make your own records, it's kind of a fun place to work.
What happens when the artist who comes to you is somebody whose work you don't admire and actually the experience isn't something that you're having a particularly good time with, even though you know that this is something that might be a big success?
I truthfully don't try to make a record with somebody that I think is going to be an unhappy, you know, it can get unhappy for many reasons.
Well, you maybe just don't like that kind of music.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. I've avoided that. I mean, when I was an engineer, I recorded almost everything that anybody ever had. And I think that gave me the roundness to understand it and appreciate it. And there are some things that if it's musical, I really can turn it down.
Do you think you listen to things differently than the rest of us do?
I believe I do. I'm not looking for it and saying, you know, there's the hit. That's the curse of life if you do that. But I certainly am listening for the quality, the amazing things that people bring to music.
And can you change our perception of that by simply moving a mic or putting a person in a different part of a room?
No, it's more about how you put them in a place mentally that they feel comfortable and trusting. It's the biggest, you know, most vulnerable place there is in the world is a recording studio. It's not glamorous, and people have this misconception that we just go in and sing and it comes out great. Now, there are occasions when that happens, but the general work-like appearance of what one wants to do every day is to create an atmosphere where they're completely comfortable.
Well, I'm sure some musicians are need that and need the comforting and the padding and all the rest and ego boosting more than others. When you're working with someone like Bob Dylan, who has been around a long time and who is famous for only wanting to do one or two takes on everything, I suspect you just make sure the mics are working and the everything is getting on the tape, or now I guess it's into the computer. And that's it.
Well, yeah, Blood on the Tracks is a perfect example of the great John Hammond and Don DeVito being in the control room with me. And, you know, my job was to be a receptionist in the best possible word of finding and hearing, you know, what Dylan is about.
Well, so you had worked on early things and then later. Haven't you worked on later things as well? This is Blood on the Tracks, isn't it?
Sounds like it.
Seen love go by my door. It's never been this close before. Never been so easy or so slow. I've been shooting in the dark too long. When something's not right, it's wrong. You're gonna make me loads when you go.
So you were engineered this one. You didn't produce it.
Yeah, my career is mixed with both engineering and producing. I mean, the years that I went back to do some of that was really from the 70s. That's where I really felt that we emerged and finally crossed the barrier. You know, the door was really closed for people like me to produce. They kept saying, no, you are an engineer. You stay right there.
It's the difference between the heads and the hands. An engineer is somebody who is seen as a techie kind of guy, not
right.
Somebody who really understands the music.
It's hard to believe that. It now is going the whole other way, because people that were musicians are sometimes not considered people who could handle the technology. It's how you're brought up. You know, I think if I hadn't spent from the early days watching great engineers work and learned the classical way to do things, plus create your own invention, it's what you do for artists that makes you okay to be in their book, and then from live appearances to everything else that I work on.
Is recording with someone like Pavarotti very different from recording with Madonna?
Quite a bit, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Pavarotti's momentum is different. Madonna's certainly got a charge and a dynamite that she brings, but so does he. And I think what you have to know is that your job is to be able to manipulate things so that if there are mistakes and errors, they're not glaring, the audience doesn't suffer from it. And I've done so many live events with Pavarotti that I know what to expect.
And live events are a whole other problem.
Yeah.
Some rooms have great acoustics and some don't.
No, most of them don't anymore. I just finished.
Why do you think that is? I mean, even the great concert halls that have been built in recent years, with a few exceptions, have not been as good as the ones they built in the 19th century.
I know. I did something, I think it was last year or the year before, at the NFL opening, and we recorded in Boston Symphony Hall, one of the greatest halls I've ever been in. You know, just some of the European halls. And we have it. Carnegie's a great hall to play in. But it
has... But not A.B. Fisher.
No. No. No, we've had to record in those places. I think people who are architects, it's like, can you build a Stradivarius? I'm not so sure you can. And we've all got the technology. But we don't do it.
So you have to do things to compensate.
Oh, yeah.
And then there are the live performances where people come in and overdub their own performances. I remember reading about Simon and Garfunkel doing that after a concert in Central Park. And I don't know what I think about that. I wonder whether, if I'm buying a record that's a concert, whether I simply want the concert, even if they did screw up.
Well, I know them both and worked on that project. So 90% of it or 95% of it was as is. There are some out-of-tune moments and little things that, in harmony, you know, these two guys are really perfectionists, and I think that tuning those is the same thing that somebody asks me now. Do we tune vocals? Well, the technology allows you to straighten out a great performance, which might not, you know, overdub doesn't sound the same.
There also are those rooms that are miracles, like the Village Vanguard. I remember years ago Max Gordon telling me that people would come from all over the world and say, this can't be the Village Vanguard. The Village Vanguard is this grand concert mm-hmm. hall, not this low-ceiling room in a basement, because too much great music sounding fabulous has come out of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. We did Mel Lewis and Thad Jones down there. I mean, again,
is small good? Some people would say they prefer to record in a bathroom than in a big space.
You know, I think it's purely the way you're comfortable. I tend to record any place somebody feels comfortable. It gives me another 50% of that person's confidence, and I'm okay with that.
And now more and more people are recording in their own home studios.
Oh,
does all the new equipment, all the digital equipment, allow for something that is the equivalent of a great recording studio?
No, it's not the same. But the technology and the microphones, unless you're using some great technology and a great microphone, can you match what goes on in the studio? But the intimacy of the home, the confidence that you have, certainly the digital equipment is way above what we used to have. It's getting better and better.
What about the people who feel that something was lost when we went from tape to digital? Obviously, you're one of those people who made a major commitment to digital. You've been credited with being the guy who convinced people to put music onto CDs.
Well, it was the beginning of a new era, a new period of time. I totally believe in the work of invention. And if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't have had the LP and things that happened. We needed to have a better format. Now, you know, I know the kind of calls you'll get from that one, but it truthfully is, unless you have a perfect playback system, as you get into the inner groove, it wasn't really as good as it was. And CDs took 20 years for us to make them sound better.
Because people had to learn what microphone placement and all the other things were optimal for the process. And then along came DVDs, which was supposed to eliminate CDs. That hasn't happened, but...
Not yet.
But DVDs really do sound better.
They do absolutely sound better. And I think we...
I'm afraid to buy, to just play the DVD records because, you know, the day I start liking them, they're going to come up with a new system.
Well, you know, the failure that happened was the surround selling of a disc to an audience that hadn't really figured it out and they hadn't marketed it. But we're making the turn around the corner.
There are people who would just prefer a natural sound instead of all the EQing and the compression.
Yeah. I mean,
what do you do when somebody wants to do it in a way that you think is working against them?
I don't think you convince people to do things that are not part of their understanding of sound. You know, I think one of the things that works really good for people, and it's great for young people to hear, you hear this in the studio, and then you play your MP3, and then you play a cassette. I mean, it's that radical. And when you hear something as you feel is natural, I mean, look, movies are not natural, yet we sit there and totally accept something when it works.
But Rick Ocasek told me that in the early days he used to play stuff back through little speakers to see what it would sound like.
Sure.
On AM radio.
Exactly, we all did that.
Now you have a new album with Gladys Knight, not like the old stuff, the Motown
mm-hmm.
stuff?
Right. I think Tommy LaPuma, who did half the album and I did, and I think we're both from interesting schools. Tommy, very well known in the world of jazz and the Diana Kralls and crossover artists. I hate those words, but they're really the right words. Gladys Knight is one of the most amazing women.
And I'm sure with that kind of dynamic range, difficult to record sometime, but if anybody could do it, it's Phil Ramone, the music producer and founder of AR Recording Studios. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
On tomorrow's show, Tom Stoppard tells us about the new production of his three-play epic, The Coast of Utopia, which is set in mid-19th century Russia. Then an ex-convict speaks out about prison rape, and best-selling Canadian novelist Lisa Moore will be here, plus historian David Nassau on Andrew Carnegie, one of the most controversial businessmen and philanthropists in American history. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. We had help today from Barbara Kahn, Angie Sheldon, and Brad Ludlow. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopez Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.